Hi everyone, it's Nancy, letting you know that this episode of the Witch Hunt podcast discusses the death penalty. Please use your discretion when listening. Also, if you could leave us a review on iTunes, it would help us out a lot. iTunes reviews help us grow and reach more listeners. We'll even send you a cool thank you gift when you message us with a link to your review. Finally, we have a limited number of opportunities available for sponsorship of Season 2 of the podcast. Trust me, it's going to be amazing. In the early morning hours of June 17, 1939, Eugene Weidman became the last person to be publicly executed by guillotine in France. Weidman had been convicted of multiple kidnappings and murders. Black and white photographs from the event show a large half circle of public viewers gathered around the site. But unknown to the executioners, someone nearby was secretly filming through an open window. If you search for the film online today, you'll get nearly 1.7 million hits. The last public execution in the United States occurred on August 14, 1936, in Owensboro, Kentucky, when Rainey Bethea was hanged for the rape and murder of an elderly woman. At least 20,000 people descended on Owensboro to witness the hanging. It was such a chaotic circus that the result was the end of public execution in the United States. And the secretly videotaped hanging of Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein on December 30th, 2006, garners just over 4.2 million search results in less than 1 second, arguably making it the most public execution ever. In the summer of 1692 in Salem, Massachusetts, one of the deciding factors in where to execute those convicted of witchcraft was location. Local officials selected a spot that's today known as Proctor's Ledge. It came to be owned by descendants of John Proctor, who was executed for witchcraft, but it had no connection to the family in 1692. It's about a 20-minute walk from the center of downtown Salem to the site. Officials needed to be certain that everyone in town would be able to get there on execution day. It worked. Welcome to Witch Hunt. I'm your host, Nancy Matus Bird. Today's episode is sponsored by Salem Historical Tours, the most recommended walking tour company in Salem, Massachusetts. You can book a public or private tour online today by visiting them at salemhistoricaltours.com or by calling them at 978-745-0666. No matter where or when they occur, certain characteristics of witch hunts remain unchanged. One of the most critical is a sort of cognitive dissonance that happens when a legal system that's supposed to be logical and dispassionate reacts to events driven by strong emotions like anger or fear. If a screaming teenage girl testifies that a wizard flew her up to the top of a mountain, or another claims that 500 witches have descended on a village with a population of 550, jurors caught up in a witch hunt will believe her and sentence the wizard accordingly. Because the hysteria grew so quickly, it could feel like the progress from accusation to interrogation to trial and execution would have been a mess of disorganized thinking and panic, but it wasn't like that. There's an overlay of pragmatism that makes what happened somehow more terrifying. There was due diligence, at least in the courtroom. A common misconception about the Salem witchcraft crisis is that it went on for years, but that isn't true. Yes, there were a handful of witchcraft accusations prior to January of 1692, and there were witch trials into the winter of 1693. However, the bulk of the action, the cases that made Salem famous, occurred over a relatively short period from January through late September of 1692. The process started with an accusation. One of the dozen or so afflicted girls and women would cry out against someone accusing them of using witchcraft to inflict physical and emotional torture. The immediate goal of the offending witch was to force the victim to sign the devil's book and become a witch. The long-term goal, of course, was worldwide triumph of evil over good. And in 1692, the residents of Salem Village believed that their tiny farming community at the edge of the New World was ground zero for this battle. Local constables would collect the accused and bring them in for questioning. This led to many awkward and uncomfortable situations, since the constables and deputies were typically local men, often tasked with rounding up friends, neighbors, and even sometimes family members. Historians who study the trials also suspect that personal animosity towards some of the less popular victims may have influenced local authorities' decision-making when issuing arrest warrants. There's evidence that constables and judges from out of town, Boston or Cambridge, for example, were slower to push for arrests or indictment than Salem-based judges who perhaps knew and disliked or even feared the local men and women being accused. Deputy Constable John Willard was originally from Lancaster, Massachusetts, about 60 miles west of Salem. But Willard ended up in Salem Village after marrying Margaret Wilkins, a third-generation villager from a large, well-established Salem family. Willard famously refused to arrest accused witches and was openly skeptical of the accusations. At one point, he's alleged to have sarcastically said of the accused, quote, "Hang them all. They are all witches," end quote. Shortly thereafter, Willard himself was accused and arrested under suspicion of witchcraft. He was convicted on August 5th and hanged on August 19th. John Willard is a difficult historical figure. On one hand, he is deserving of our sympathy for being accused and executed for a crime he didn't commit. On the other hand, scholarship indicates that the reason he was accused wasn't so much because he openly criticized the trials, but rather, he had a reputation for beating his wife. Several members of his wife's family testified against him, and central accusers Ann Putnam Jr. and Mercy Lewis testified that the ghosts of people Willard had murdered were appearing to them. Interrogation followed accusation. Suspects were typically brought to the town meeting house or to the local tavern when they ran out of room in the meeting house. And there really were those humiliating scenes in which the accused, mostly older, extremely modest, and deeply religious women, were stripped naked and subjected to the kind of body search one would expect on being incarcerated in a supermax prison. The examinations searched for two things. One was something called a devil's mark, a spot on your body indicating that you'd signed the devil's book and he'd marked you as his now. The other thing was a witch's teat, a small flap of skin that a witch allegedly used to feed her familiars. Familiars were animals or animal-like creatures that witches could send out to do errands. Any sort of a birthmark or a skin tag was damning. Interestingly, recent scholarship by European witch trial experts has shown that rather than going after midwives and accusing them of witchcraft, a very popular theory for many years, the exact opposite appears to be true. In many cases, authorities actually hired midwives to conduct the physical examinations of the accused. I'm going to pause here and say thank you to our sponsor, Salem Historical Tours, the oldest established walking tour in Salem, Massachusetts. Whether you're a history buff like me or just like getting the lay of the land when you're on vacation, a walking tour is an ideal way to get acquainted with a new city. Salem Historical Tours offers daily history tours and nightly Haunted Footsteps ghost tours. All of their tours are led by licensed, experienced tour guides with the scholarly knowledge to teach you the history of Salem in a way that's fun and entertaining. You can book your tours online at salemhistoricaltours.com or give them a call at 978-745-0666. Now back to the podcast. One reason we know so much about the Salem witch trials today is because of an act of poor judgment. Early on in the crisis, John Hawthorne and John Corwin, the two local Salem magistrates in charge of the interrogations, opened them up to the public, something that directly contradicts law enforcement best practices both today and in the 17th century. Hawthorne, whose great-grandson was giant of American literature Nathaniel Hawthorne, was famous for his guilty until proven innocent style of questioning, but it wasn't that unusual. Unlike today, there was no presumption of innocence in the colonial justice system. You were considered guilty until proven innocent. And in only one case that made it to trial, that of 71-year-old grandmother Rebecca Nurse, did the jury return a verdict of not guilty. If you remember from episode 6, after the not guilty verdict was announced, the afflicted girls went into such fits that Judge William Stoughton instructed the jury to go back and deliberate again. This time, they returned with a guilty verdict. The death sentence followed all guilty verdicts, including for those 55 people who actually confessed to witchcraft. Although not everyone who was sentenced to death was executed. In several cases, the hysteria simply ended before the sentences could be carried out. When that happened, the governor commuted the death sentences. Today, the time between sentencing and execution for death row inmates in the United States is about 15 years. Once the death sentence is announced, an automatic appeals process is triggered. In 1692, there was no formal appeals process, although in many cases the families of the condemned wrote letters to officials pleading for their relatives' lives to be spared. In Salem, as in all of Britain in the 17th century, capital punishment was purposely a public spectacle. Retired engineer and historian Richard Clark is an expert on the history of the death penalty in Great Britain. In addition to running the Death Penalty UK website and the Facebook page by the same name, Clark has written two books about the history of putting people to death in England, Women in the Noose and Capital Punishment in Britain. He spoke to us about how capital punishment worked during the witchcraft hysteria. When we're talking about the Salem witch trials, you know, many, many people mistakenly believe that the men and women who were convicted of witchcraft in 1692 were burned at the stake. Could you just explain why that is not what happened?
When Henry VIII introduced a statute for witchcraft, he did so to make it a felony. Felonies were punishable by hanging. Only treason and heresy were punishable by burning. So in England and Wales, witches were only ever hanged. In Scotland and in much of Europe, they were burned. But as Salem was under British law and in 1692, hanging was the only available punishment.
In my mind, death by hanging has to have been a particularly brutal and painful way to go, especially, you know, if there wasn't a gallows and you didn't die instantaneously from your neck snapping. Am I right, or was death by hanging more humane than it seems?
I think it's far more humane than it seemed. The short drop produces unconsciousness within about 10 seconds. Their body will continue to make movements which will be construed as struggles by the witnesses, but the person actually hanging feels very little after about 10 seconds. Their working group on human asphyxia went into this in huge detail, and they're very, very qualified medical personnel. And this is the conclusion that they came to.
Now, the idea of a public execution in the United States is very far removed from what I think would be culturally acceptable. But for, you know, many, many years, executions were public events. Why do you think they were public events in history? And why do you think they're not public now? The rare occasion when someone in the United States is executed, it's not public.
The reason they were public was because there was very little media, only newspapers. An awful lot of people were illiterate, so they couldn't read the newspaper. And it was far simpler to have public executions so that people could see justice be done. Strangely, the last public execution in the USA took place in this state, i.e. Kentucky, in 1936. The local Louisville newspaper slated it because people had enjoyed it too much. And it's very clear from public executions or public hangings in Iran today that people still do.
Any guess as to why?
I think it wouldn't be anything I would want to see. I think there's a lot of morbid curiosity and probably other elements to it as well. But they're certainly clearly very popular. people like to see justice done.
The other aspect of the executions during the witchcraft hysteria that has always struck me is the way that they were scheduled. They were scheduled in rounds. Trials were practically happening every day from June through September, but there was only one execution day, June 10th, when just one person, in this case Bridget Bishop, was hanged. The remaining 18 executions happened on three different days. There were five executions on June 19th, and then five more a month later on August 19th. And then the executions ended on September 22nd, when an astonishing eight people are all hanged on the same day. Why were executions scheduled like that?
This was normal practice. In London, the court, main court, was called the Old Bailey and still is. And they would have sessions. So people would be tried individually. At the end, they would be sentenced. And then there would be a hanging day. And then they would be taken to Tyburn in a cart and all hanged together. It was cheaper. It was simpler. You had to have security at hangings, even in those days. So there were probably troops of javelin men and all the officials. And it was far simpler to do them as a batch rather than individually.
So it was a logistical thing.
Absolutely, yes. It was perfectly normal to do this up until well into the 1760s.
It's also important to remember here that none of the judges or prosecutors were lawyers in the same way that we think about lawyers today. The contemporary track, if you want to be a lawyer, starts with earning a bachelor's degree, then a law degree from an accredited law school, and finally passing the bar exam. The first U.S. law school, the Litchfield Law School, was established in 1784 by Judge Tapping Reeve. By the early 19th century, Harvard, Yale, Columbia, and Penn State all had established law schools. However, lawyers becoming lawyers by going to law school was still the exception and not the rule before the end of the 19th century. Before that, men became lawyers by, quote, reading law, end quote. A sort of independent study where you'd immerse yourself in classic legal texts combined with an apprenticeship with an experienced attorney. In fact, the three-year law school requirement wasn't established until 1906 by the Association of American Law Schools. John Hawthorne, John Corwin, and Bartholomew Gedney were the three local men Governor William Phipps appointed to the Court of Oyer and Terminer, a special court set up specifically to hear witch trials. The remaining six judges were Boston or Cambridge men who were appointed to the court because of their political, religious, and military leadership, not for their legal expertise. The Chief Justice was William Stoughton. Stoughton was born in 1631 in Dorchester, Massachusetts. He grew up in a wealthy, well-established family. After earning a degree in theology from Harvard, Stoughton traveled to England, where he earned a master's degree at Oxford. His mentor when he returned to America was Reverend Increase Mather, one of the most influential religious and political figures of 17th century New England. Stoughton was also a contemporary and close friend of Mather's equally famous son, Cotton. Both Mathers steadfastly believed in the dangers of the invisible world, and this certainly influenced Stoughton's thinking. He has come down through history as one of the most zealous supporters of the prosecutions. In fact, when the hysteria is over, Stoughton becomes enraged when Governor Phipps stays the executions of people like Elizabeth Proctor, whose execution was delayed because she was pregnant at sentencing. While seemingly in contradiction to how the American legal system works today, in 1692, the judges also essentially functioned as prosecutors, but Massachusetts Governor Phipps did appoint two men, Thomas Newton and Anthony Checkley, as the official prosecutors during the witchcraft trials. However, their roles were more clerical than prosecutorial. They wrote up the warrants and other documents, and they decided the order in which the accused were tried. But they didn't question witnesses or deliver arguments to the court. The court did include judges whose enthusiasm for prosecution didn't match that of Corwin or Hawthorne. Nathaniel Saltonstall famously resigned from the court, allegedly because of his dissatisfaction with the way the trials were being conducted. Likewise, judges Thomas Danforth and Samuel Sewall also attempted to insert a measure of caution to the proceedings. Some of the jurors, judges, and even one of the accusers, Ann Putnam Jr., later issued statements of regret. But all of their apologies deflected some of the responsibility onto the agents of Satan. They were sorry, yes, but they also claimed victim status. The one exception was Judge Samuel Sewell. A wealthy Boston-based merchant, Sewell came to deeply question and experienced intense remorse over having participated in the trials. Remember, the Puritans believed that when something bad happened in your life, it was a judgment from God. Within 5 years of the trials, two of Sewell's daughters and his mother-in-law died. His wife Hannah gave birth to a stillborn baby. Sewell very likely experienced these deaths as a profound judgment on his witch trial participation. He wasn't alone. The Commonwealth declared January 14, 1697, a day of fasting and prayer for the sins of the witchcraft trials. That morning, Samuel Sewell handed a note to Reverend Samuel Willard during services at Boston's Old South Church. Willard read it out loud to the congregation. In the note, Sewell expresses overwhelming remorse at having participated in the trials and tells the congregation that he, quote, desires to take the blame and shame of it, end quote. There are no qualifiers, just a deep, heartfelt public apology. In fact, Sewell dedicated much of his public life to atoning for his trial activities up until his death in 1730. Also in 1697, a group of men who'd served as jurors during the trials signed a declaration of regret, publicly asking for forgiveness. But they also shift much of the blame away from themselves and onto the forces of darkness. Quote, "We confess that we ourselves were not capable to understand, nor able to withstand, the mysterious delusions of the power of darkness and prince of the air," end quote. The common thread that runs through every apology, however, is the abiding belief in the invisible world and in the power of witchcraft. At no point did anyone involved in the prosecution or the execution of the accused question whether witches were real. What they regret is the way the prosecutions played out. It became clear that the rules of evidence were not being applied properly. The heavy use for conviction of spectral evidence, this idea that a witch can send her specter or spirit out to torment victims, particularly came into question. It's astonishing when you think about it. Even the innocent men and women who went to their terrifying deaths in 1692 died believing in witches. Each of the 14 women and 5 men hanged just knew they weren't one. The Witch Hunt Podcast is written by me, Nancy Matus Bird, and produced by Dan Bird. Thank you to Richard Clark for helping us get a clearer picture of what capital punishment looked like in Salem. You can buy Richard Clark's 2 phenomenal books online. Thank you to Cody Dexter for our theme music, and to Adam Dreyfuss for our logo. You can follow us online and find show notes for each episode at witchhuntpodcast.com. You can follow us on Facebook at Witch Hunt Podcast, on Instagram at Witch Hunt Podcast, and on our Twitter feed, Witch Hunt Pod. You can also email us at witchhuntpodcast@gmail.com. Again, it would be really helpful if you could leave us an iTunes review, and there's directions on how to do that right on our website. Thank you to our sponsor, Salem Historical Tours, the most recommended walking tour company in Salem, Massachusetts. Book your tour online at salemhistoricaltours.com or give them a call at 978-745-0666. Thanks for listening. We hope you'll join us next time for episode 8, Making It Stop.